Okay, at this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety and attendance at a group conscious meeting. My name is Jorge. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is May 1893. I'm sober only by the grace of God, you know, AA and you guys. I drank for many years and I got into a lot of trouble. I got my first DUI when I was 14. I didn't have a driver's license, you know, and I didn't learn my lesson. But thanks to AA, you know, I was able to straighten out my life. I had to go through a lot of trouble, but I ended up here. I thank God for that. And I'm glad that I never left. You know, from the very first day that I came here, I kept coming back. And I believe you guys. You know, I didn't believe my teachers. I didn't believe my parents. I didn't believe a priest. I didn't believe any authorities. You know, that I was going to get into a lot of trouble if I kept on drinking. But when I came here, I don't know. You know, there's a special bond between alcoholics, you know. And I know that you know what you're talking about when you tell me what you went through, you know, the suffering, the guilt, the remorse, all that, all those feelings from drinking. And I could relate to all of you. And I'm glad that I met you all. And thank you for your support and for your prayers. You've done lately for me. You know that I was put away for a while, but I'm back and I'm glad to be here. And thank you. Now I'm going to introduce our speaker, Brian. See, I met Brian about 3 years ago when he came here. And even though in the beginning we didn't talk much, but eventually Brian helped me more than what I helped him, because I was going through some financial difficulties and some trouble, and I came to a meeting and I was feeling bad for myself, you know. I was in self-pity. And he approached me and invited me out to lunch and listen to all my crap, you know. And I'm sitting there with 13, 14 years sober, and this guy, you know, he's got a year and a half, and he's helping me more than I'm helping him. And I didn't know at the time, but he had just gone through the same financial difficulties that I had done. You know, so he knew exactly what was going on in my mind. And since that day, you know, we became good friends. He invited me out to, he knew I was depressed. And I could show it, you know. He invited me out to the beach. We went out on his boat. And I remember I had not been in the beach in probably years. And, you know, that experience just made me feel so good. You know, so good, because I had not seen the water, had not been out there having fun. And he helped me. He helped me a lot, you know, and I remember we went out there. He invited me out fishing. But he didn't know that the last time I had been fishing, I was only 8 years old, you know. So when he asked me, he said, "Well, so when was the last time you fished?" I said, "Well, when I was 8. He looked at me and he said, "Oh, no, don't tell me I'm going to have to teach you how to use all this stuff, you know." And I said, "Well, yeah, because the last time, you know, I remember swinging my fishing hook." So, but I'm a fast, you know, learner, and he taught me once, and I picked it up right away, and I was catching fish before he caught his, you know, so that was cool. But, and I'd be hanging out with him. We went to the Gator Nationals. We had a good time, you know, without drinking. And, that's the kind of friends that I've found in AA, you know, and I've seen him come to meetings, and I've seen him grow, and I've seen him go struggle, but he's always back, and that's what it takes, you know. And I'm glad that he said yes to come here and share his experience, strength, and hope. And with that, I'm leave you with Brian.
I'm done. Yeah, I told Jorge a long time ago, I said, I don't look forward to the day that I might get asked to speak. I'm going to be very nervous. So he gets May, and man, I knew I was screwed then. So glad that everyone's here. And I guess, you know, my sponsor, I don't even see him, and that kind of pisses me off. Must be here somewhere. He told me to make some notes and here and there, and I heard from a lot of other people don't make notes, so I didn't make any notes, so I have no idea what I'm going to say, so I'm just going to start with that. I grew up about, 5-6 miles from here, the Real Pinard Country Club, back when Orlando was not too... Can you guys hear me in the back? You all right? Okay, when Orlando was not the way it is. I moved here in 1971. I was 4 years old. Disney opened that year, so I think that made the whole, you know, economy and all the people start coming in, and I watched it grow and grow, and I had a great childhood. You know, I'm one of those, I can't complain too much about my dad or my mom. I can't say that I was mistreated. I can't say that, you know, I was unfairly handled. I really don't think that's true. But I think there's definitely something to be said about the way I thought from very early on. I think everyone in here can relate to wanting our way and wanting it now, not having any patience, not having any real humility. I remember as a very young boy, 'cause I was raised in the church. I was raised at a Lutheran church, and it's still there. There's a little church on Lake Underhill, right across, right before you get to the hospital there, a little bit east of Cimarron, a little tiny church with a big mural in front. My next door neighbor paid for that mural to be put up there when his wife died. Warren Moss is a great guy. But I would go there and listen, and I don't remember getting a thing from church. You know, and someone said in here a long time ago, a speaker said, I don't think there was anything really wrong with the messenger. I think there was something wrong with the receiver. You know, and that's truly what I got from it. I think that I went through all those years thinking about, you know, what I could be out doing or what I was missing or what is this BS that I'm hearing, instead of, you know, a wise choice of letting some of that stuff sink in. Of course, I'm never going to agree with all of it. I'm never going to agree with all the things I hear, but in the book it talks about how we look at religion and we pick out all the bad things about religion. We pick out all the things that, you know, the wars that people have died, and all the, you know, the Spanish Inquisition, and all this, you know, these things that happened because of, in the name of religion, and the hypocrites. That's the best one. The hypocrites that are in church. When, you know, in turn, I learned it with a little bit of age and wisdom that I was the hypocrite sitting there. But I chose to look at those things, the negative things, instead of the positive things that God does and that the church does in this world. But I think you know, my first real memories was my mom being sick, and I don't know if I can blame this on anything. I still struggle with it. My mom was sick all my life. She was she had a very rare disease, and when I was young, she was still fairly healthy. But as time went on, you know, I never knew whether mom was going to be in the hospital or whether she was going to be you know, at home. She wasn't able to do some of the things that, you know, that the other kids around, you know, the guy next door, my best friend David's here, and his mom was just like an angel. She was just always, what do you want, honey? Do you want a little sandwich? Do you want this or not? I thought that was the norm, you know, and I would come home and mom would be sick. She couldn't help it. And I was resentful because of that. I was like, why aren't you up getting me a sandwich? You know, why aren't you doing stuff for me? Why are you complaining about all the laundry? So that's from early on. That's the way I chose to look at things. You know, it's about me and what can you do for me? So You know, as time went on, I think the way I dealt with things, the way I dealt with my mom being sick, I was always gone. I was out. I was, you know. And, I hear people speak up here all the time, and alcohol's, you know, when I went to rehab, they told me that someone said alcohol was the first thing I picked up, and alcohol was the last thing I put down. Because they always ask you, what's your drug of choice, right? Well, my drug of choice was anything that was in front of me. I mean, if I had the opportunity, I was going to do it. So the reason I say that is I'm going to be mentioning some things that I may get beat up for later. But it's part of my story, you know, and it's just the way it goes. So hear me now and beat me up later. My first real experience with alcohol was, I think I was around 12 or so. Well, no, I'm say something to my dad's here. So he gave me a beer when I was about 8, I think. He gave me a full beer, and I remember him giving it to me and going, wow, I can't believe he's giving me this beer. And I drank it, and I drank the whole thing, and I remember getting a buzz from it, and I said, this is it. This is it. You know, I like this. I like the way this made me feel. I feel calm. I feel a little better. I feel a little more comfortable in my own skin. At a very young age, you know, I thought this is going to be something I'm going to pursue. So when I think I was around 12 years old, and I went across the street, and you probably remember this. Dave was across the street, and he said he had some vodka, and he had some orange juice, and he said, why don't you drink this? So he filled up a little kitchen glass, halfway full of vodka and halfway full of orange juice, and I drank it, and then I said, I'll have another. And drank two of those, and I don't know what I weighed, about, you know, 75 pounds, 90 pounds, I don't know. But that was enough to get me beyond, you know, where I wanted to be. So I came home, and I remember walking in. I remember we had a bird sitting there. His bird was sitting on the cage, and I walked up to the bird, and I tried to, you know, do something cool, do something in control so they know everything's good. You know, 'cause I knew all eyes were on me. I always thought all eyes were on me. But I went up to the bird, and I tried to pet it, and I remember just kind of squishing it on its cage. And, and then I walked back past the bird and walked to the hallway, and everybody's watching TV, peaceful night at home, everybody's happy, seemingly, everybody's fine. And then I came in, you know, walked back to the hallway, and I'm, you know, kind of bouncing off the hall, trying to get back to the bathroom where I'm going to, you know, remove this stuff from my system. And that's what I started doing, and that created a little bit of havoc in the household that night. My dad got madder than I'd ever seen him. My mom was, you know, screaming, trying to defend me. And I turned this peaceful evening into one of the worst nights that I'd ever seen in my family. And you'd think that, you know, that kind of thing might give me a clue as to this might not be a good idea, this drinking thing. But I'm sitting here, so I guess it didn't. So after that, you know, I started getting into some, you know, little stuff, you know, a little crime here and there. And I lived in a nice neighborhood. You know, we never wanted for anything, but we weren't really wealthy like the people that lived around us. So it's another reason I thought I was shortchanged in life. It's like, I don't got a brand new motorcycle. You know, I don't have the brand new car. So what's up with that? You know, I mean, I live here. This is what I do. This is what things happen. This is how things work in this neighborhood. Pop, let's go, you know. But, you know, I think he was doing the right thing, trying to get me to work for things. And I did. I started working, you know, kind of young. But I remember looking at guys when I got into middle school, and the guys that surfed, and they were walking around with their eyes half shut and red, and thinking, these are the guys I want to be in life. This is it. You know, this is who I'm going to emulate. And boy, I wish that was different today, but that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be the surfer that couldn't barely talk and that had 4 brain cells. And I actually achieved that goal. You know, I did. You know, I started doing what they did, and I started hanging out with people that I thought were cool or whatever. And started getting into trouble. You know, got arrested a couple times. I used to steal my dad's car when I was about 14 or 15, maybe. I'd go out the window and I'd put his car in neutral, and he always left his keys where I could find them. I mean, that's a bad call, but I'd get the keys, I'd push them out, I'd push the car. We had a long driveway. I'd push it all the way down the driveway and get out there and start it up, and I was off to Oviedo to this girl's house. I got away with that a lot, you know, but I got caught a few times. And one of the times, you know, I put the thing in the ditch, and there's Dave. I call him at 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, "Hey, I'm out in Oviedo in the ditch." And he's like, you know, he's 14 years old. He's like, what the hell do you want me to do about it? You know? So I'm walking back, and I played soccer in high school, and I had a cast on my foot because I had done some damage to my foot. And I chose to walk on that cast and ruin the operation, and I got sand all in it, and yada, 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 and the police pull up, and they see my car, and I go to open the glove compartment of my dad's car, and he's got a gun in there. And they won't ask for my driver's license registration. I said, well, I don't have a driver's license. I was 15, maybe. And I saw that gun in there, and that changed things a bit. So after that, I got caught one or two more times doing the same thing, and they decided to ban me from Oviedo. That was back when it had, you know, less than one spot, you know, stoplight. So, but I was no longer welcome there. In my early teens, I had, you know, I mean, I could go on and on. I'm sure I could tell you all kinds of stuff, but I think that some of the things that changed me was, that should have given me a clue, was when I was 17 in the mid 80s to late 80s, it was fashionable, kind of, or I don't know how to put it. I think it was acceptable. It was something that a lot of people did, that they put their kids in drug rehabs, and it was much more prevalent than it is today. And I got put in one called Straight. I had the distinguished honor to be the first person admitted to the Straight program here in Orlando, right off of Silver Star there. So that was a bad place, you know. It was a bad place. I see people nodding. You know it. Yeah, that was a bad place. And I'm sorry, but I don't think it did me any good. You know, I didn't listen to anything. You know, I didn't listen to anything they had to say. I was 17 years old, and if my ego is a problem today, it was vastly worse then. 17-year-olds think they know better than anybody else, and you know, that's a problem I still struggle with. But I didn't listen to a word they said. And then about a month later, my girlfriend gets put in, but I've been going out for 4 years, so that put the whole thing into another little loop. But I spent a year in that place. I turned 18, and they were all thinking I was going to walk when I got to 18. But that's the first time I started feeling like I wanted to bang my head into something hard and die. I couldn't believe that I was in that place, that I'd hurt my parents to the point where they thought it necessary that I had to be there. I didn't think I had a problem. I had a problem. But I had done, at that point, I had done, you know, a laundry list of drugs and alcohol. So I certainly did have a problem. And my dad knew I was an alcoholic 20 years before I did, or that I had those tendencies. And I walked into that place, and in order to get noticed, there was little groups of people. They'd taken them from Tampa. And I forgot to mention that my other really, really good friend, Joe, ratted me out. And the guy that sold me my first bag of stuff goes to my parents and tells me, this boy's got a problem. This was 10 years later almost. And I'm like, man, I'm going to kill you when I get out of here. That's for positive of that. But I went in there, and they told me I was going to some family counseling, and I wound up, you know, doing it the hard way, and I stayed there. I walked in, and there's these little round circles of people, and they're all sitting on the floor. It's a big warehouse, 10, 12 times the size of this, just cement floors, gray walls, you know, just sterile-looking, nasty place. And they're sitting on the ground, and they're, in order to get noticed, in order to get called on, in order to show their motivation to become better, they would have to wave their arms like this, right? Really hard. So I walked in, and you remember this? You know this? I walked in this place, and little groups of people waved their arms. Like I said, I'm definitely in the nut house. There's no question about that. So it was a scary time, you know. And you know, like I say, after a year of that, I don't really think that I learned anything. I don't remember ever saying, oh, that makes sense, or that. You couldn't. I mean, if you had to go to the bathroom, there was a guy holding on to the belt loop of your jeans, and they would take you to the bathroom by your belt loop, and they'd stare at you while you did it. You couldn't read any literature of any kind, watch TV of any kind. So really, the focus was on how bad of a person you are. You're a bad person, right? And that's what I get out of it today, really. When you were talking, you'd stand up and talk about your problems. The people would do their weirdness, and they'd stand up, and they'd say, you know, you're full of crap, and da da da, and they'd work you. And it was a kind, loving, nurturing environment would be a lie of the 10th degree. But it was what I learned from it was, I think, that today I can look back and say, you got a problem when you don't even know you have a problem. And you sometimes need to rely on people that are around you to say, man, something's messed up and you better take care of it. Well, I was getting that message when I was 17 years old. And I didn't get sober till I was 38. And I forgot to mention, that my sobriety date is May 23rd, 2007. It took me a little while to get that through my head. Unfortunately, alcoholics have the tendency to be beaten into submission until we actually get the message that we need to change. Something needs to give. So after I got out of that place, I lasted a few months, and then I went back to my dealings, and I got into some. That's when I really got bad. Right around when I was 20, I started getting into a lot of fights and a lot of drugs of every kind that I could put my hand on. I remember the first time that I actually did a drug, the peer pressure thing was, I always wondered about peer pressure. Who's pressuring who? You know, because I was the one looking out there. I was trying to find it. I was, the first time I did it, my best friend Dave over here, he's sitting right in front of me looking at me doing it. And I'm like, you want some of this? He's like, no. And I'm like, all right. And I did all of it that was in front of me, much more than I needed to do, not knowing what would be the result. So I really didn't care, you know, what happened. I remember thinking when I was pretty young that I would rather been puking from being too drunk than just feeling like I normally felt, which is a sad thought to have. But after I got out of there about 6 months, about 4 or 5 months later, I started doing stuff again, and I started working at Peabody down here. I was just talking to somebody about that, and I was a waiter in there for about 6 years. We were in the fine dining room. We had the tuxedos and all this and that, and the fine wine and all this garbage. And I got into wine, and I got into wine hard. I thought that was my calling. You know, I need to teach people about wine. You know? I studied it, and I got a job offer to go to down here to Isleworth Country Club, and the maitre d' there was this guy that I thought was just the. I thought he was the best. I thought he was awesome. He's cool, man. This guy's cool. That's what I thought. And about a month after I get in there, they caught him drinking out of a vodka bottle in the liquor room. And I was his assistant when I got there. And they fired him. And I thought to myself, what a knucklehead, man. What an idiot. How can you be drinking out of a bottle of vodka, you know, on the job? And, man, I don't know if he was as bad as I was at the end, but that was nothing what I did at work. But they fired him and gave me the job. So I was 22, something like that, 23, and I had the whole clubhouse. It was awesome. I had pro golfers all talking to people that were famous and walk around in my tuxedo with my glass of wine. I was supposed to walk around with a glass of wine, you know. I held the classes for that stuff, and I got into it. And I always started where the wine was fine, you know. I would drink some wine, and then, after a while, it's not quick enough, right? Liquor's quicker. And I would drink a few glasses, but after everyone was gone, you know, I remember one day an employee said to me, he goes, you know, everyone's about ready gone. You can go into we had a restaurant there called the Windermere Room. He said, you can go into the Windermere Room now and drink your face off. And I was just stunned by that. I was just like, someone knows I drink, you know. I think they all know I drink. That's another big thing that we do, you know. We think that people don't know, and man, they know before we do, you know. And when I did my amends, I was talking to people, and it's the same thing. It's, you know, I was doing this. I was like, yeah, I know. How the hell did you know? How did you possibly know? I was so smart. So, you know, I moved through that, and my next job, a guy approaches me and asks me if I'd be a wine representative. And I got to not only be a wine representative, but I got to live in New Smyrna Beach, which is where I spend most of my time. And I said, you want me to sell wine, and you want me to live at the beach? Okay, I'll do that. I'll do that. So I went and worked for Premier Beverage over here. They're off of, I don't know where anymore, but they gave me lots of samples, you know. And I, you know, we had a trip to Mexico once to see how the agave plant was done. And I wound up getting, intoxicated that I got mugged. I got locked up in a jail. It was a scene, man. There was SWAT. There was a fight. It was just ugly. The guy that I was with is a big guy, and he stands up, and they gave us this massive bill. You know what? When we got into the taxi cab, they were making fun of the taxi driver because he smelled. And then they said, take us to a good bar. Oh, that was perfect. So he took us to like the worst, nastiest, sketchiest bar in Mexico. And these bodyguards came up to us, and you know they were watching us. And I proceeded to do what I did and passed out at the table. And they took my wallet. And the next thing I knew, I was in a holding cell outside because the guy next to me says, I'm not paying this bill, and somebody's getting hurt. And so that we got hurt. We got sent into this little jail on the outside, and it was freezing cold in Mexico. And I'm sitting there just shivering. And then they let us out, and there was a fight and this and that. But couldn't get back to the States. I don't know how to get back to the States. I had no information on myself. And that was a funny thing that happened, right? I mean, when I got back, that was the big story at the water cooler. Big funny stuff. So I stayed there for a year, and I went down to South Florida, and I opened a couple of restaurants, and wound up, and I would drink. I was, through my life of working, I would drink throughout the day, but I was functional, right? And then around quitting time, it would get to where, okay, now I'm going to drink to where I just make it home and I'm out, because I don't have any patience for trying to go to sleep. I don't want to have any, I just want to pass out. And I like the buzz. I probably like the buzz a little bit. So, you know, I got through a lot of years of some pretty good jobs doing that. You know, I would drink, go home, pass out for 15 years I did that. And I didn't have any consequences through that, except for that every year that I drank and every year that I didn't do what I was supposed to do in my higher powers eyes, I got further and further away from him and into myself, and then came this, you know, inevitable demoralization. But I got through a lot of years of doing that, and then when I came down here, once again, Dave, I was up in California, I was in Santa Barbara at the Cal, great job, really great job, I loved it over there. Right in Santa Barbara, I was running a golf course, the food and beverage there, and man, it was, you know, I could take off. I had my surfboard in the storeroom. So when it got good, I was like, see ya. You know, I was out and I did my thing. I golfed 2-3 times a week. Beautiful course right on the golf course, right on the ocean. And, I got a call from my friend saying I'm making a lot of money in real estate back here. And, you know, I said, nah, this is too good up here, you know. And I had some sobriety then. I had some periods of sobriety. I knew it was a problem. I got on the, what is it called? Anabuse. I went to the doctor. I said, hey, look, I can't stop drinking. I'll go for a week, maybe two if I'm lucky. My day was 4 days. I don't know what it is, but I would not drink the next day, feel horrible, and the next day I'd feel a little better, the next day I'd feel a little better because the hangovers were serious. And the fourth day I'd be like, in my mind, my mind's language was, you got a lot of drinking energy built up. That was the way I spoke to myself. I said, drinking energy, where did that come from? You know, did I read that? I read that in some philosophers, you know, is that good stuff? But I got a lot of drinking energy, so I'm going to go today and I'm going to take care of that problem. So I would start the cycle over again. I got pulled over a couple of times. One time I'd been drinking since probably 10 o'clock that morning. It was about 8 o'clock that night. And I don't, you know how we drink. We don't drink and then stop and then start drinking again. We drink and we keep drinking. So I was drinking, you know, I was probably 10 hours and I got pulled over and I thought, this is the DUI. I was in Maine at this point. I was living in Maine for a little while. And, he told me to walk the heel to toe to the car and I did that and with perfection and couldn't believe it. And he said, go home. I was like, and I'm in the car. I had a girlfriend at the time. She was screaming at me, you know, because I was screaming, give me a DUI. I was out of my mind. I said, give me a DUI. I'm screaming to the cop, give me a DUI. I deserve it. So anyway, I got to move on. I moved back here, and what I think this opportunity did for me with David was that it gave me time. It gave me time to do whatever I wanted to do. I didn't have a job anymore that I had to report to. I didn't have anyone that I was responsible for. I didn't have employees that I had to look after. It was just me. So, man, the game was on then. That's when I really started drinking really, really hard. I had all the time in the world that I wanted, and I had no one really to account for me. It wasn't my, you know, David, what's he going to, you know, say to me? I'd tell him to, you know, stuff it. You know, he's my boss, though, you know, but I'd be like, too bad. So he came over several times, and I was out of commission. You know, I'd be, laying in the middle of the floor, no clothes, crap everywhere, kicking at me, saying, hey, man, what's wrong with you, you know? One of my girlfriends at the time called, she called Dave, she called my dad, she called, I don't know who else she called, but she came home about 11 o'clock in the morning, and I was, lying in a pool of my own whatever, and they took me to the hospital, and I got there, and they asked me if I'd ever felt like hurting myself, and I said yes, and that was a big mistake. So they took me to the Baker acted me, and I got to spend some time with some people in the mental hospital. So you know what though, I came out of there even who I was then. I came out of there saying, man, I'm blessed. I'm blessed. These people have real problems, and I'm making my own. I'm making my problem. These people have no choice. They're insane. They have a mental problem, and I have a heart for those people. But I came to a point where I really wanted to die. You know, I got in the bathtub and did the whole thing. You know, I wrote a little suicide note and started doing what I was going to do, and then realized it hurt. So that was out. But you know, to be in that spot, it's I can laugh about it now. But when you're at the point with drinking where you can't feel good anymore. Even when you wake up and you don't know what day it is, or if it's day or night, or what happened in the last few days, and you're listening to your voice messages, you're seeing what you did and what you didn't do. There's no escape from yourself anymore, you know, and that's where alcohol takes you. And you can sit there and believe me, or you can sit there and think I'm different. But if you're in here, you'll be back, is what I think. It always catches up to you, you know. If I'm not trying to do my higher power's will, then something's going to happen in the long run. David came pick me up, said, if I'm going out of town, I'm going to Tennessee, and I'm afraid if I come back, you're going to be dead. So you're coming with me. So I went up there, and on the way back, he said, now you're, you know, close to on the way back, he said, now you're going to rehab. And I said, no, I'm not. He said, yes, you are. And my family all wanted, my sister set it up, you know, I put her through a ton. And I was talking to the guy, I said, I'm not coming in. I called the place, and I said, I'm not coming in there. And he said, you know, why don't you just get away from life for a while, get away from the job, get away from the career, get away from the people, and just come here. And that spoke to me. That said, you know, something about that makes sense. Get out of life for a minute. Take a break. Come in here and listen to some people that know what they're saying. And I had the woe is me thing, you know. Life's treated me badly. And one day, one of the counselors in there said, you know, you can forgive yourself and move on, and try to change yourself, or you can keep carrying the cross like Brian over there. And that really pissed me off. But the things that really piss me off are the things that I've learned today, are the things I really need to hear. The things that I really don't want to hear and that really irritate me are the ones that I probably need to listen the most to. And so that got me, and I just so chose to drop that hole. Okay, let's move forward. Let's forgive myself. So I did my four step, you know, resentments. I said to my sponsor, I got no resentments, but I had huge resentments against God, against myself, and I had to work through those. I thought God wasn't doing what He was supposed to do, and that's why I was in the position I was in. So I came out of there, and I came here, and I told you guys before that I don't remember coming here. I don't remember how I got here. I don't remember how I found it. I'd been sober a month and a half at that point. I don't remember anybody saying anything that irritated me or that made me think, ooh, that's cool or that's good, or I just was like, I don't know what happened for about a month, and then I started, you know, it took me about a year probably to start talking to people, and that's a wrong thing to do, you know. I would come in here, I would listen, I would talk to no one, I would leave immediately after the meeting was done. And when I started to go against what I thought was good and make myself available and start talking to people, that's when I started, I think, to grow and to be able to be there for someone else. So I made myself. I was sick and tired of hearing it, you know, help another alcoholic. I'm like, screw the other alcoholics. I'm trying to help me, you know. So I actually did that. I actually tried to help another alcoholic and, you know, had a good amount of sponsees. Several are still sober. Thank God. But those are the best moments in this program, is when you're going through the steps with someone and the lights come on and you're like, wow, that was unbelievable. And, you know, I had a time just about a month ago or so that a friend of mine, and I brought two friends of mine that I work with here to this meeting. One here to this meeting, and the other one I gave him a big book, and he's not coming to meetings yet, but I'm working on him. God's working on him. You know, he called me one day and he said, I feel like dying. So I went over to the house. I didn't know where he lived. He lived way up. I went over there and he was in bad shape. And I ended up calling the police and having him, Baker acted. And, he's sober today, and he hasn't been sober, for more than probably a week since he was 12. You know, and he's sober 2 months now. And these are things that I get from working the steps, you know, the powerlessness, all this stuff is, you know, to me, I have my own beliefs in my higher power. I call him God, and I believe that I try to read the really big book as much as I can, and I go to church, and I think this is a condensed version of what I do at church, is what I think. And it dumbed this down, it dumbed my thinking down, it dumbed my committees down, doing these steps to the point where I could say, okay, I got it, I understand. I've got to give up my will, my God. I've got to give up my life to Him and make sure that and make sure that. That I'm trying to do His will instead of mine. And that's something I'll probably struggle with the rest of my life, because I want to do my will. But I find that when I'm trying to do His will, amazing things happen. Miracles happen. I'm here today because, you know, I'm doing His will. I'm trying to. And once I break down the walls of my lack of humility or my pride, and I let someone else take the reins for a moment, it works. Man, I didn't think this was going to happen. So, anyway, I'm very grateful to be here. I'm very humbled to be here. And, you know, I was talking to my girlfriend. I've been dating this young lady for, I don't know, 9 months now, and she's a daughter of a Baptist minister, and doesn't have a past like anything like mine. I'll tell her stuff, and her eyes are just like, bing. I'm an anomaly to this young lady, I think, but we all here are not, and you know, it's amazing to watch someone who's trying to walk the walk that, you know, we have an instruction book for life, and I just never read it. And someone who's tried to walk that walk, the solid ground that their face sits on is amazing. So I'm in the learning curve right now. I've only got 3 years, not even. By the grace of God, I'll wake up tomorrow with 3 years sobriety. And I'm really you know, I'm still very, very young in this program, and I've got a lot to learn. But the foundation has been laid, and if someone can come in here and tell me that that they can work the steps without a sponsor, I'll say good luck with that, and I probably won't talk to them much more. You know, that may sound bad, but I'm done. I mean, you can't do it. You need a sponsor to guide you through the steps. You need a sponsor to tell you where you're wrong and to see you and get to know you. And over the years, can say, hey, you might want to rethink that thought. Or Angel said something the other day, and I'm going to go against him for a moment here. Well, prayer and meditation is everything, you know. And this guy, Angel, has been someone to me that I love. Everything he says is amazing, you know. And there's a lot of people in here. Brian, you know, a lot of people in here that say that they speak the truth. I look up to him very much, and I'm probably missing 10 at least. But I wonder if God speaks to you, you know. And you may not be schizophrenic if you hear something, you know. Because that's what he said. And I said, you know what? There's times when I'm quieting myself down and I'm trying to do my 11th step. I'm trying to pray and meditate, and something will come that is out of the blue, that is a trust me or in my time or something like that. It may be God. It may not be God. I really don't care. Because if I wasn't sober and I wasn't coming to these meetings and I wasn't trying to do the right thing and help the next alcoholic, I would not hear those things at all. And I'll take that away from those prayers and say that was God. Because I wouldn't be here without some of that help. So I'm really happy today. I really am. I've got everything that I need. I don't have everything I want, but I never will. And I found that when I get things that I want, I don't want them anymore. I want the next thing. So I've become a little more humble, a lot more humble. And I think that humility is the thing that I'll always chase. Because being humble is something that I'm not. And I never will be. But I have a template, and I have a plan. And I have the people to talk to, Jim and all these people in here, Bob. I mean, it's a blessing beyond price. So I thank you for letting me speak. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian, for your service work. The group asked me to remind you to please clean up after this meeting inside and outside the building. Due to complaints, please respect our neighbors by avoiding excess noise, verbal arranging, while on and leaving the property. We would also like to remind everyone of our 12th tradition, which states, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all traditions ever remind us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.